Thank you all for coming. This is my third version of this, and which means some of you have suffered through this twice before. So I'm going to hopefully promise this is going to be the last time you hear me talk about this topic. And the topic today, of course, is given a whole bunch of source code from, say, one distribution of something and another thing, how do we find out if there's any similarities between the code of these two things? Or in fact, I'm also going to talk about comparing multiple things at the same time. In the past, I've produced tools that have been slow but worked and were reasonably fast and worked. This time, I finally worked out a way of doing it fast and elegant, so I want to talk a little bit about that. I also want to thank Paddy along the way, because he came and tapped me on the shoulder just before Christmas and he said, "How are you going with your research?" I went, "Ooh." I'd actually got halfway through something in my break, and then a conference followed up by 2 weeks of flu, sort of, and a new course to prepare sort of knocked the skids out from under me. So it was good timing, and after the during the exam period and having a bit of extra time meant I could actually finally get it finished. So this is where this whole last bit of research has come from, the last few weeks of December. Some of you will recognize the first four or five slides, so I've sort of borrowed them from previous talks. Why do you want to write a tool that compares trees of source code? Well, for us, we get student assignments, we want to make sure that they're reasonably independent. We want to detect if there's any code sharing between students. And I've actually used my tool in the past to do this very successfully. Another reason is you may have a code base which you believe is infected from code that came from somewhere else, or alternatively the other way around, you might think that some of the code that you own has been leaked out and has infected another tree of code. Now, it could be between two trees that are proprietary and somewhere along the way there's been some NDA that's been broken. How do you actually prove if you go up to court and say, "Well, I want you to give me your million lines of code"? How are you going to sit down and say, "Well, I've got a million lines of code and here's the competitor's million lines of code"? It's going to take an awful long time to actually find out if there's anything that's similar if you're going to do it by hand. Alternatively, you might have, we've got a lot of open source stuff floating around. Of course, they pick up patches and extensions and code from anywhere, from just random developers. So you also want to make sure that if you're developing a product or a tool that gets software from random people, that it's not infected by proprietary stuff. And also, I've got an interest in tracing code genealogy. So how does code evolve and change as new versions come out and as things fork into new variations? So of course, being able to look at something from year X and something from year Y a few years earlier and see how much overlap there is sort of indicates how much has been kept, how much of the product has changed.
Would it track some of the open source projects you get so far then they branch?
Yep.
So this would help?
Yeah. So see where the branch occurred and what was common at the branch time and then what's also diverged, if a patch from one side has not been taken up by the other side, things like that. Now, of course, we're looking for comparison at the source code level. So we need to worry about what can you do to source code. We obviously want to find whether these lines of code are identical to these lines of code, but of course people are either do make changes because they want to, or they make changes because they want to hide copying. So they want to rearrange code. Maybe they've taken 20 lines up here and moved it down to the bottom. Are we going to be able to spot the similarity if halfway down all of a sudden a subroutine or whatever has been moved to somewhere else? Also, are we going to be able to detect what I call code munging? In other words, seriously malicious attempt at obfuscating and hiding the fact that code's been borrowed. So whether we rename variables, whether we rename functions, things like that. Students do it all the time. So you end up with one program with X everywhere and one program with Y everywhere, and they say, "Oh, but it's different because he's used variable X and I've used variable Y." And you've got to be able to say, "Yes, but there's an exact, one-to-one match between these two things." The other problem, especially in a legal situation, is that if you suspect your competitor of stealing your code, you can't go up and knock on their door and say, "Excuse me, would you mind giving me your code?" You can do it once you get to a legal setting. You can do discovery and actually oblige them to give you copies of your source code. But of course, generally speaking, you don't have access to proprietary source code. What if these two companies, before they get to court, want to go to a third party to help independently verify this. In the past, what you have to do is give both code bases to the third party. You have to trust that they are going to be ethical and not leak or pass on anything from one tree to the other. How fast is it to do the comparison? It's obviously got to be fast enough that that it's useful. I'll talk about a case in the past where someone spent about 6 weeks to do a comparison and how I can do it a little bit faster these days. And of course, if we're doing comparison of two trees or more, what's the rate of false positives? How many miscomparisons are we going to detect that aren't actually there? And of course, even worse, we want to make sure that there are no mismatches, that if any possible similarity is detected, and there's not a chance that things will slip through the cracks and we'll just miss them. Okay, so here's a bunch of requirements that I think we need. We obviously need to be able to detect rearrangement of code to some extent. It's got to be reasonably fast. If we're expecting to be able to deal with proprietary code bases, we need a way of exporting the code base in such a way that the structure, the essential structure of the code is still exported without actually divulging enough of the original source code to allow people to reverse engineer and get back the original source code. So there's a tension here. We've got to release enough of the code so that it can be compared to other code bases, but at the same time we can't release all of it, otherwise we're just giving away or we're just divulging the whole original code. And of course, I've talked about the code munging. It would also be good if we could detect substantial renamings of things like variables, constants, functions, and that sort of thing. Okay, so those are the basic sort of things I set myself as goals to try and achieve, that I can write a program that will do all of these things. Now we're talking source code. My original approach was to do it lexically, not semantically. So in other words, I'm not trying to extract the meaning, but what I'm trying to do is to break the trees of code up into the basic lexical tokens. And then what I want to do is to find sequences of tokens that are similar, that are the same between multiple trees of code. So I'm getting rid of all the semantics, what does the code actually mean? I'm keeping a watch out for, you know, if this for loop is followed by this if statement and then there's some curly brackets and then we make another decision and we do some assignment statements, then as long as all of that code is identical in terms of the keywords and the structure, then I can say that the code's identical. So what sort of tokens do we have in most languages? We've got single characters, parentheses, brackets, that sort of thing. Multiple character tokens like ++, ampersand. We've got the keywords in every language, char, int, return, if, for, while, that sort of stuff. And we're also going to have to deal with literal values, so that if we spot an identifier for a variable, that we tag it and then notice that that is variable X and we keep track of it. So some of the tokens actually have values. So identifiers, functions, variables, structures, that sort of things. All of these have values. So too for literal strings, literal characters, literal numbers. Why did I choose this? Probably the main reason was I came in from the point of view of I wanted to help out in a situation where a proprietary company had claimed that Linux had stolen millions of lines of code. And of course, when you make an arbitrary claim like millions of lines of code, then you start thinking, well, there's got to be a way of disproving this. So I wanted to be able to take it to the point where you could use this to filter all of the trees, leave behind the similarities, and then you could walk into a court and say, well, here is what's in this tree that is similar to what is in this tree. How much is it actually the same? Are there really millions of lines of code, or is it three lines of code, or is it somewhere in the middle? And of course, we want to be able to make non-programmers understand the similarities. So if they can see for x equals naught, x less than 100, x plus plus, and in the other tree, for x equals naught, x less than 100, x plus plus, they can see the similarity. Of course, this is not just the only approach that you could do for comparing trees of code. You could compare intermediate forms, you could compile down to bytecode if you're doing a Java comparison, and then you could compare the bytecode. You could compare functional results. You could actually run the programs with inputs, see what outputs they provide, and if the inputs and outputs are identical, then you could say, well, I don't have to look into the program, I can say they're functionally equivalent. That doesn't sort of stand up in a law court, because non-programmers are going to go, yeah, but they might just be written independently, but they produce the same results. And there's also been work to identify and compare the basic algorithm units. So walking along a singly linked list or iterating over an array, that sort of thing, you know, matrix operations. So there are at least multiple different ways you can approach this problem. So my approach is really from the pragmatic point of view of, can I show this to people in a jury? This tree and this tree have these similarities, and it should be pretty obvious to them that those are actual similarities. So far, so good? So you've got the idea of what the problem is in my approach towards it.
Question on how you're determining similarity. Similarity is a dimension, not an absolute.
Yep.
And since you're within a programming language, many of the tokens, they're going to be similarities just because you've got a limited vocabulary.
Yep.
You can use.
Yep.
So how do you determine whether something is similar, given that everything's going to be similar to some degree?
Yeah. That's a good question, and I'll come back to that in about one or two slides. But that's a very good point, and I do need to raise that.
Well, when something is related within a given programming language, particularly more structured one, you get higher probabilities of keywords.
Yep.
So even if it munched, the keyword placement must be the same or it won't compile.
That's true. So it's like an educator or a...
So you put markers.
Yeah, you've got things that appear in certain places to make it functionally do the same sort of thing. But I'll come back and talk about these things. Now, if I'm going to go for a lexical approach, and I also want to provide an avenue where we can export some essential structure of the program without actually exporting the entire program itself, I decided what I would do is I would tokenize every tree, and then I would serialize the string of tokens. So every source code tree is converted into a serialized stream of tokens, and I call that a CTF file. Each token is represented by one byte, so that means you can only have about 256 token elements in your language. And literal values are hashed down to 2 bytes. So every time you see the word X, you run it through a hash function, you take the 16-bit number that comes out the other end. I also include file names so that I know which file is affected or which file is represented in the stream, and also the date of the file. So what do you get at the other end? You get a file that has all of the essential tokenized elements without actually revealing the actual names of variables, the actual literal values. So therefore that allows the code tree to be exported, which reveals enough structure so you can say, well, there's callers and there's an if statement followed up by an assignment statement and access into an array without actually knowing what variables controlling the loop, what variables is controlling the if statement, what's the name of the array. Now, of course, literal values and the names of things are hashed down to 2 bytes. That should hopefully obfuscate so that you can't take the hash and go backwards and say, well, I know the number's 56, I can therefore work out what the original variable means. There's obviously going to be hash collisions, which sort of works to my advantage, so that whatever you think is the hash name of the variable, you can't really guess what the original name was. There could be dozens or hundreds of thousands of different possible variable names that would come down to the same hash value. And of course, there's going to be hash collisions. So there could be multiple different variable names out there that would hash down to the same value. So this really does help to obfuscate the code base, but then I'll talk about how we can actually use that to do the comparison.
Why keep information at all?
Well, if you just say for any variable equals 0, any variable is less than any literal numeric constant, then so many for loops are going to be equal to, are going to be similar to other for loops that the comparison becomes nearly pointless.
But I mean, if you just change the X to Y.
Well, that's the code munching. So I'll talk about a solution to that near the end as well. What I'm saying is, if one code tree says for X equals 0, X is less than 100, and another one says exactly the same thing, what I'll end up is for hashed value equals hash literal constant, semicolon, hashed variable less than other hashed literal constant. And I can see that those sequences of hashes and tokens are identical.
The actual hash value may be different. What do you get by converting it to a specific value instead of the same yield of that?
I'll just make it faster because hashing.
Did you could just insert a constant?
I could have inserted, yeah. I could have chosen the first variable is going to be number one, the next one's going to be number two, the next one's going to be number three. Hashing just makes it a lot faster. Because I don't have to keep track of which variable have I seen before and go and look it up, and just take a hash on it. Trust me. Ask me that question in a little while.
I'll ask it again.
Okay. Here's an example of a string, where you can see the line numbers I've kept on the left. I encode the line, the existence of lines, so that we can recreate what the tree sort of looks like. But of course, when I do comparisons, the lines themselves are actually not used. So we've got a token do set, left curly bracket. We've got an identifier, identifier 891 is equal to identifier whatever, square brackets, and some other identifier. So that's obviously an array access saving into a new variable. We've got some if statements, and right down the bottom we've got a while loop. So while some identifier is less than another identifier plus a numeric constant. Okay, now, if one code tree comes out with those set of tokens and hashed values, and another code tree comes out with exact the same tokens and hashed values in the same sequence, then that's the way I decide whether there's similarity between the two trees. Now, to answer your question, where do you stop? Obviously, if there's an if statement and an if statement here, there's similarity. And there might be if left parentheses, and that's similarity as well. So halfway through this research, I decided, well, there's got to be a minimum threshold where you say that's similar and anything below that doesn't count. So I did things like, if left parentheses x is greater than y, close parentheses, max is equal to y, else max is equal to x. And that's around about 12 to 15 tokens. And the standard for loop for x equals 0, x is less than constant, x plus plus, that's around about 12 tokens. So I said, well, we're starting to get down to smaller than the basic unit of sentences in a grammar, in a language. So somewhere around about 16 tokens is where I arbitrarily lay my threshold of similarity. So once you exceed that, then you can start reporting similarities. Once you fall down below that, then it's so small as to be meaningless. Okay, now, of course, you might find, here's two pages of code, you might find a run of 20 tokens similar up here and a run of 20 tokens similar down here. Then there might be a big gap of no similarity. And then you might find 50 tokens down here and 50 tokens down here. So you report the similarities and you don't report the non-similarities. So that's the sort of level of similarity detection that I'm doing. So you get a printout which says that these lines, these two programs were similar. That these lines, these two programs were similar. So it identifies the bits that are similar. It's then up to you to go back and do some eyeballing to see whether this is representative of real copying. Okay, obviously the longer the run, the more likely it is that there's been some code use being shared. Now, I'm going to quickly go through the past two attempts to let you know why they were so bad. The first approach was very simplistic. You walk along one tree, and every time you get to a token, you go, okay, well, that's an if. Let's walk along the other tree and find an if. Aha, we found an if. Let's then proceed in parallel to find the limit of the similarity, and if it is greater than 16, we report it. If it's less than 16, we don't report it. Okay, done all of that, finished that comparison against one token. Now we move over to the next token, and we repeat the process. Okay, it works, and it's slow. And it's order m times n, where m and n are the number of tokens in each file. Extremely slow, but it works. There's no false negatives, and it does find all positives. So apart from the very, very slowness, the other problem is that if you have 15 trees and you want to find the similarities between all these trees, let's say you've got 15 students, well then you've got to do a pairwise comparison, another pairwise comparison, another pairwise comparison, and that's really bad. So that sort of was a good approach for about 12 months, and then I gave up on it and moved to the second comparison. I sort of sat down and thought, okay, we know that a run of 16 tokens counts as the minimum amount of similarity that we're looking for. And I also sort of thought, well, how do they do genome sequencing? What they do back in the early days is they would stuff your DNA into a bottle, they would slice it up with chemical scissors, and they would sequence all of the slices, and then they'd use a computer to try and work out how to put all the bits back together again. Okay, so it's called shotgun sequencing. you slice up your DNA, you work out what the runs are, and then you try and match up the runs. So it's like a big jigsaw puzzle. So in my second approach, I thought this is going to be a great idea. What we can do is we can break each stream of token up, stream of tokens up into groups of consecutive tokens, which I'm going to call a tuple. And the tuple is of size n, typically size 16. You take all of these tuples that you've sliced up through all of your trees, shouldn't have done that, and you throw them in a big bag. And every time you pull out one tuple, you then search around in the bag for other ones, and you go, hey, presto, I found a match. Put that match aside. And you keep doing this, finding matches, putting them aside. The only problem is, these only indicate potential runs of similarity, up to 16. What you want to do is find out if those actual runs of similarity can be extended in any other way, in any way. So what you then have to do is merge them all together. You've got to go, well, this similarity was on line 100 of this file and ended in line 103. Or over here, we've got a similarity that starts at line 103 and goes to line 106. Well, jigsaw puzzle, I can join those together because they're adjacent. Then you do that with all the other ones at the beginning and at the end, and eventually you get this run of 56 instead of just 16. Okay, so it's a lot faster than version 1. And the basic approach is I take the tuples and I hash them. So I'm comparing hashes rather than actually trying to compare runs of 16.
But at 16, your threshold for similarity, what's the difference between a run of 16 and a run of 50? It's similar at 16, it's not more similar at 50.
Oh, it is more similar. If I say, if there's only one line, if x is greater than 7, but then if I have 20 lines, then that's more similar.
But your threshold for similarity was 16.
Yep.
Anything beyond that is also similar.
Yes.
And since all you're looking for is condition of similar or not similar, degree of similarity, where does that play into that?
Okay, think about it pragmatically. I could report to you 1,000 snippets of similarity of size 16, or I could merge them all together and only report to you 7 runs of similarity of size about 100 each. Which would you rather see as a human being who has to try and identify if these two trees of code are similar? Do you want to see just snippets of one line here and there that are similar? Or do you want me to join them up so you can actually see a whole page of code that's similar? I would argue that you'd want to see the whole page that's similar.
I think it would depend on the decision you're being, you're being asked. And you could do it by percentages too.
You could do it by percentages too. So what percentage of this file and what percentage of that file is similar?
Right.
Yep. So, but my idea is that the longer the run, the better. So that, you know, you say it's more similar, not just similar. So the possible chance of it being just written arbitrarily, independently, is lower if this run of similarity is longer and longer.
I think my question is driven by, at that point, you're not just talking about similarity.
No.
You're actually talking about something else. I'm
so
not
the
quite
way
sure what it would be, but it isn't just
similarity
anymore.
No.
And so it might be an interesting thing to think about is what does that really indicate above and beyond the fact that these two things are similar, one or copy.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, you get something about the token. You've got an atom, if you like, of similarity, but just the extent of similarity. I mean, I think, to get up to this point, if you get a run of 16, it will be within a run of 50 anyway.
Yeah.
And a run of 50 will trigger multiple runs of 16, which you then have to go away and pull up.
Yep, and merging and bootstrapping together, So, this was the approach up until the middle of last year. And it was fast, and of course it also allows multiple trees to be compared, because if you pull out a token of a tuple of 16, and you find any other tuples of 16, they can be in multiple different trees. And so you might find 6 or 7 of these things, and you go, well, okay, there's at least a similarity of 16 between this tree and these other 5 or 6 or 7 trees. So you can do it, I won't say in parallel, not parallel in terms of parallel CPUs, but you can do multiple comparisons simultaneously. But the big problem was that the merging was ugly. It's like doing jigsaws. It worked, and I had some heuristics to make it reasonably fast, but seriously, the code made your head hurt, even if you knew exactly what the code was doing. So, version 2 sliced the streams up, found the matches in the unordered set, and then rebuilt the runs of similarity to make them as long as possible. But But by having the unordered set, more work had to be done to do the merging. So instead, what I realized was, well, you know, I'm processing these trees left to right, I'm, you know, top to bottom, from the beginning of one file down to the end of one file. And I'm going, there's a group of 16, there's another group of 16, there's another group of 16. So if I'm already walking these trees sequentially, as soon as I find a similarity between this tree and this tree, well then, I can just put that similarity aside and say, well, it's a potential run. And I can go back to look at the next set of next tuple, which will then, if there's a match again, I can say, well, okay, the only possibility that that could do is either extend the one I've already found, or it's a new one, and I can just put it into the pool. So at any one time, you've got a possible match, you've got a whole bunch of previous matches from just the last tuple, which you can either extend, and then eventually when you stop extending a run, you can say, well, that one's complete because I couldn't extend it on the last pass. I can now put it out and claim it to be a fully complete run of similarity. So instead of having to do the jigsaw puzzle, I can now just walk and sequentially extend the existing partial runs. So if we find a match, we know exactly what existing runs may need to be extended. And if we don't find any existing runs to extend, then that also means the runs that we have in the bag that possibly could have been extended can no longer be extended, so they must be complete. Now, I threw the little algorithm up. I'm not sure whether you want me to go through it. Basically, for all of the trees and for all of the tokens in the trees, we build a tuple. If we find another tuple that matches, well then, possibly there's an existing run called R which is already out there that we can extend. So we can extend R to make sure that T and T2 now form the end of it. Otherwise, we couldn't find an existing run that's already out there, so we just create a new run. Put the run into the list of still incomplete runs, go back and slide down to the next tuple. That tuple may extend some of the existing incompletes, or if we didn't find anything, we now know that that run is fully complete. The runs that were incomplete because we couldn't extend them are now fully complete. And then once we've done all of that for all of our trees, we can then simply spit out the comparisons, the runs that we found. So the algorithm is like, I think I've got a slide here, 40% smaller than it was in version 2, and it's also about 3 or 4 times more elegant. Like, you can actually understand it as against not understand it. It's also about 5 to 10 times faster than version 2. Now, version 1, I was never sure whether it was linear or exponential, exactly how it scales. I've done some performance comparisons with this one to actually try and determine what it was. So I was a bit pessimistic and I thought version 2 was n squared, which means as you throw more trees and more lines of code in, it's going to start slowing down very quickly. Now, just quickly, I need to tell you a little bit about the heuristics. How do I find a run of n tokens matches another run of n tokens that are already out there? Well, especially when they're 16 bytes long, you have to basically do a 16 byte versus 16 byte comparison, which is not exactly fast. So instead of doing that, I keep a hash table with linked lists hanging off the hash table so that I can actually find the tokens. So I hash a tuple and then I find the appropriate hash point, run down the linked list to pick up any matching tuples. So it's a fast way of finding, fast way of doing a 16 or n byte comparison. Because I'm using hashes though, there's always a possibility of collisions. I'm using a 32-bit hash. So there is a distinct possibility that there will be some collisions. So at least for the first tuple in any sequence, there is about a 1 in 2 to the power of 32 chance of a hash collision. And so therefore what basically I'm saying is this piece of code, which doesn't really match that piece of code because of the hash, will accidentally be marked as being identical. Now that's only going to give you 16. As soon as you move up to the next token in the sequence, you're going to move up the tuple to the next run of 16, and therefore the likelihood of that also having a collision is going to be much, much lower. It's like 2 to the power of 32 times 2 to the power of 32, or maybe 2 to the power of 33. It's going to be very small. So effectively, you're going to get possible false matches, but only about one in every 4 billion. And the size of the similarity is going to be exceedingly small. Now, when you have found a match, you've got to then go back and find if there are any incomplete runs that need to be extended. And again, the run is going to be of arbitrary length, so again, I'm going to hash that down so that I can find it pretty quickly. This time, because I'm running out of memory and I don't really want to feel like writing yet another hash plus linked list structure, I'm just using a 2 to the power 24 bit hash. So there is a low probability that I'll miss finding a run that can be extended. Not find a run that doesn't exist, but not find a run that is out there that needs to be extended. So what can happen about a chance of 1 in 2 to the power 24 is that I've got this run that I'm slowly building up, that's getting longer and longer and longer, and all of a sudden I find a pair that match and I can't find the appropriate run to extend. So what will happen at that point is the run that's already out there will be treated as being done, and I'll start a new run instead of actually merging the two together. So that's low probability, but it still can exist. What it means is that I won't lose information. It's not as if a similarity will fall through the cracks. But instead of something, say, being 100 tokens in length, it might be 60 followed up by 40. So there's a possibility that a run that of similarity of certain length might get split in the middle. But like I said, the possibility of that is low but not zero because I'm using hashing. Okay, so how do you do performance analysis on this? Well, and I wanted it to be realistic. I didn't want to just throw in artificial stuff. So I went off and found a bunch of code trees. I wanted to make sure that some were related. I wanted to make sure that some were not related. And I also wanted it to be realistic. So I wanted millions of lines of code to do my performance testing. Because I run the Unix Heritage Society, I grabbed a whole bunch of Unix trees from 1973 up through to the late 80s. I grabbed a couple of Linux kernel trees, one from very early Linux, threw up to a Linux from a couple of years ago, and in the mix I threw a whole bunch of application trees that were completely unrelated, just so that if you throw stuff in there that's not going to match, how does it affect the comparison? So what I would do is a cumulative comparison. I'd start with 2, I'd do the testing, I'd then move up to 3, move up to 4, move up to 5, and then try and plot the performance as the input size increased. So what was I trying to measure? Well, obviously the overall runtime. In terms of what I'm comparing against, I've got possibly the number of tokens in the total input, the number of comparisons that I make in the input, and of course the number of complete runs of similarity that I've found. Okay, so here's the first graph. What you would hope is that that as you find more runs of similarity, it's going to take a reasonably linear time to find more and more and more. And there's bumps along the way, because as you add trees, sometimes the trees are heavily related, sometimes the trees are not so heavily related. So it is cumulative, but there's a little hiccups along the way. Right down near the bottom left, there's this very fast increase in speed, in time. At the beginning, where there's very few tokens, you spend most of your time doing the hashing on the tokens. So therefore the initial cost is just the hashing. Later on, when you start finding substantial runs of similarity, then you spend more and more time finding runs and then extending existing runs. So at the beginning, the CPU is dominated by just the hashing cost. Later on, hashing becomes cheap and the actual finding extra runs and extending them becomes more significant. I can't tell whether that's linear or not. But it is, and unfortunately you can't see the scale down to here, there's about a 10 to the power of 3 difference between the values at the beginning and the values at the end. So it does sort of extend over a scale of like 100 or more.
And this is over a fixed data set. So
this is over a fixed data set.
Code basis, so you use that as a reference.
Yep.
Kept cycle.
Yep. In terms
of... This is only CPU time, not...
Just CPU time. Yep. I'll talk about memory usage. And I also made sure that I wasn't...
I was thinking about I.O. because many times you've got small code bases, you spend half the time doing I.O.
Yep. And then that
distorts the whole
thing. That's true, I shouldn't. No, this is real CPU time as against raw clock time.
Yeah.
So I.O. is taken out of the equation. Yeah. Although, in fact, it generally turned out to be extra 5%. So never bit me very hard. In terms of just the number of comparisons between things, when I found a match and found a tuple and then found a match against it, again, it sort of looks linear. But I really sort of need more to throw more input at it to make sure that this is the case.
That looks like the Indian one-day cricket team.
It does, actually.
And what was that, Pavan? You're cheating, Paddy. There's more than 11 players in here.
And of course, I wanted to measure it against the total size of the input, so the total number of tokens. And lines of code doesn't really make sense because some lines are short, some lines are long. So measuring against the total number of tokens, you can see that again it looks sort of linear, but then you get this little worrying tail at the top here, which sort of possibly makes you worry whether it's n squared or not linear. So you sort of, I sort of get the feeling that it's sort of linear across here, but then there's something happening up here that could be causing it to start shooting upwards. I was worried that just the size of the input was starting to overwhelm it and cause it to slow down. So I thought, well, is it because we're getting more similarities up here, or whether it's just because we've got more input and it's just the cost of finding matches based on the size of the input? So obviously the heuristics help improve the performance. For small input, hashing is the dominant cost. For related trees, as they get large, the cost to actually find matches is the dominant factor. Runtime versus number of tuples, it could be linear, could be exponential. What I decided was, well, how do I know whether it's the matching that's costing me or whether it's just the size of the input that's costing me? So I decided, well, what I'll do is I'll create some artificial trees of code, just token sequences, that are completely non-similar. So completely as random as possible to minimize the possibility of any matching. And if it's just the input size, even with trees that don't match, I should still see that possible exponential. Here's the random code trees. And apart from the blip in the middle, which is probably just a measurement artifact, it looks quite linear to me. So in other words, I'm getting the feeling that it's not the size of the input that's causing the thing to go up at the end, but it's possibly the fact that I'm getting starting to get more and more similarities. Okay, so the stronger the greater the number of similarities, the more it's going to cost you to run this thing. So in other words, it's not really linear in terms of input size. It's going to be possibly linear. Oops, going the wrong way. It's possibly going to be linear with the number of runs that you find out the other end. Okay. So in other words, if there's a strong similarity, it's going to take you a lot of time to find it. It's going to take you more time to find it. If there's no similarities or few similarities, it's going to cost you less time to make that decision. And I'm pretty much at the end. So let me tell you where we are. It's a very elegant algorithm. It's certainly more efficient, and it seems to scale much more linearly compared to the previous two. On my poor old 2 GHz P4 at home with a whopping 1 GB of RAM, I can throw 15 trees with nearly 3 million lines of code in, and that will spit out about 3 million runs of similarity, and that takes 36 seconds. Okay, now, I was going to tell you about a case study way back in the 90s when Unix and the BSD guys were fighting as to whether there had been any copying. One of the BSD guys sat down with the two trees and did a hand comparison. It took him about 6 weeks, and he found something like about 96 lines in total of similar code. I can do the same comparison in about 0.01 seconds. Okay. And we're talking about 200,000 lines of code in total. So the time to actually do hundreds of thousands of lines of code is down under a second. Millions of lines of code were up into the 30, 40, 50, 60 seconds. And like I said, that's not linear in terms of the input size. It's linear in terms of how many things you find similar. The big drawback with all of this hashing is that it costs you a lot of RAM to do it. So 3 million lines of code is costing me about a gigabyte of RAM to hold while I'm running. And memory usage is proportional to constant times the number of tokens plus constant times the number of runs that you've got. So if I had a bigger system, I'd be able to compare more lines of code.
Probably different figure.
I know, but my poor old box at home doesn't have more memory. I mean, I've got a box sitting on my desk I should use.
But I think we can get the machines that might be able to do that and give it everything to develop.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, some of these things before, there were anomalies generated to do with page sizes or paging algorithms. If you were getting, if you were approaching certain triggers in the object, it would start to swap and page more. So suddenly you generate gates.
Yeah, I've been very careful to make sure.
And it was just due to underlying memory management issues that you were getting the anomalies, and then I couldn't really see that. It'd be interesting if you did it instead of the new machine to be faster, but to see whether, if you had more memory in it and running the same simulation, whether they they changed or whether the kinks still were there.
Yeah.
I mean, it would appear that depending how you do the similarities, that kind of linear algorithm.
Yeah.
So you're saying that if there are next to no similarities, so I'm not triggering that algorithm often, your base algorithm, wouldn't you? And it's only when you start to trigger your second algorithm.
Yep. So with no similarities, it's basically a linear operation, but then when you get similarities, then you start saying...
But you could understand that. It was the other one I didn't understand. Not that one I didn't understand.
Why it's going...
Because it's covering the wrong way.
Yeah, I know. That was worrying to me. Now, of course, something I haven't done is that I've got all these trees, and I'm comparing one, then putting two in the mix, putting three in the mix, and putting four in the mix. What I should really do is effectively a permutation of ordering, so that I could actually throw different trees into different orders, and then plot all the graphs on the same graph, and then basically I should get a smooth line which indicates what the real behavior is. Because obviously, this tree and this tree are very similar, so that's why there's an increase in time. Whereas this tree versus this tree is not so similar. There's a lot more stuff going in, but the time difference is not as great. So obviously reordering is going to change the plot. So I really need to sit down and do some permutative output collection and then try and average.
I think beginning this week, I should have realized you were still fixing that particular problem, but Mark Paddy, I think Zendak, Marcus Myler, that we do have a research cluster now.
Yep.
We've got a cluster we can use for computational intensive research, and we're trying to work out software we could use to allow distributional work through the cluster.
Yep.
And secondly, we'll be trying to identify research projects that can benefit from using it, so we can perhaps market them a bit more effectively.
Yep.
So now this is something you could use the
CPU and bandwidth and memory. Now, munging, I forgot to mention munging. Variable rename. What's that? Because you were the one who asked the question.
What is munging?
So if student 1 has X and student Y has, student 2 has Y, what you can do is you can just set up a
Phil.
Oh, it's Phil. No, it was one of you two. Well, I'll shoot it at the chair.
This question was similar to munging.
Yeah. So, well, it's easy. In fact, it turns out to be like 10 lines of code. You basically set up a match table so that every time you see this variable, and if you see this variable in the other tree, well, then there's a relationship. So then if you see the same one again, you see whether in the other tree there's that name. And so you basically do an isomorphic comparison. It slows you down a lot because you've got to keep tally of which variables you've already seen and which matches there possibly are over on the other side.
But you keep the variable name.
I'm using hashed names, for instance. I'm not actually using variable names. I'm using the hashed equivalent.
Yep, so you work out which hash number corresponds to which hash number.
Yep. Let me quickly show you. Are you going to say something?
That only does the alpha conversion type munging. But what happens if you move code around, which are sort of independent?
Well, as long as I say... It doesn't really matter, because I do keep variables across one file.
No. Suppose one is a function call, and the other one is an array assignment, and I flip the two because they're independent. The tokens won't match.
I'll have to try that. You have to give me a sample, and I'll try that and see what it does. I'm not sure what it does.
Right.
How do you test in these runs for all other than maybe?
I haven't tried to yet, but I can't see a way of getting it. Like I did say, the only possibility is when a 32-bit hash accidentally collides with another hash.
So two things coming and end up having the same.
So it's reverse osmosis on this hash.
I don't think I can find it.
Do it by hand.
Do it by hand.
I mean, one thing you can sometimes do in these is to construct a test set of pathology.
Yeah.
And to
create
something that does what that wants.
Yeah. That's why I'm interested. If you've got ideas about what things like a test size,
question: would this work on Bitcoin?
It should, yeah. There's no reason why it shouldn't work on Bitcoin.
And I'm just trying to think, in the bulk of the Microsoft, in terms of Java systems,
yep,
have used Bitcoin, and Microsoft, the CLR, compiles down to Bitcoin.
So you should be able to compare
to Bitcoin. So you should be able to.
Yeah.
Like Bitcoin compare.
The problem there, though, is still a little shaky at definition of similarity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the reason that mismatches may be important is you're providing a little bit of a mixed message, and okay, similarity is based upon this arbitrary number of 16.
Yep.
But at the same time, we want runs, so the 16 now be even more arbitrary.
Yep.
But some of our runs may be split, so the runs really are not all that important because we're going to split them and we don't care. And now
I try not to split.
Yeah, you try not to, but
yeah,
if you admit that it can, it's rare or it's unlikely.
I actually did do a test,
but
like
the mixed matches, if you had a situation where you're now looking at some percentage of similarity, and if you have missed matches, you might not reach that threshold. You might miss 10% or 20% or 30%.
Yep.
At which point, you're now not able to say definitively, we have this degree of similarity between the two.
Let's say you only wanted runs of 20 or wider. All you do is you say, well, now I'm going to make my tuples 20 bytes wide. So you don't have to start at 16 and extend. You can start at any arbitrary number and extend from that point onwards.
Okay, but what if I want to know percentage of similarity?
Okay, yeah.
And so now if you're missing matches, then you cannot say definitively in a legal setting these two are X percent exactly the same or similar.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's even of import, but
no, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But you can say it is at least so much. It could be higher.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. There's a minimum similarity.
But then that readily raises the question: what do we mean?
I mean,
by
if it's at least 90%, then you know there is.
Yep. And there's a strong chance that these good people have borrowed the code from each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I want to quickly show you is just the output, because I've told you about the thing that I need to actually show in action. So here's this thing that this guy took 6 weeks to do back in the 80s. And here's the most, and I've also ordered the results by most frequent runs.
No wonder they were talking about software engineering, quotes per manner, lines of code per manner.
Don't you love the amount of commenting they used to put in the program? So there's a run of 35 tokens. There are the two files and line numbers. And there you can actually see the similarities. So we can see from here down to here, here down to here.
Now, in terms of munging, if I just quickly go back and turn on isomorphic comparison, the first one should still be the 35, I think. It's a little bit slower. Oh no, okay, the first one, now we have a whole bunch of constants that match other constants, but then there's a one-to-one ratio. Let's actually get down to the code. Let's see if we can find some code here. This is the problem when you do isomorphic comparison, that any constant matches any other constant, and then you end up with all of this rubbish. How would we look for an if statement?
I thought it looked like a very normal C compiler.
Okay, no, that's not what I'm after. There's an example of an isomorphic one. Let's just turn off the if tagging.
You can see that the code originally said, in fact, that's the original one, flag and lock. Now it says flag and ILOX. So that bit of code and that bit of code are actually the same in terms of having the same functionality. But of course, just a straight comparison wouldn't have found them, because that literal constant doesn't match that literal constant. And of course, there's also the problem of what's the threshold of how many one-to-one matches are you going to have. If you have too many, then anything will match anything. So I also have a threshold of what's the maximum number of matches that I'm one-to-ones that I'm allowed to accept. the more you put in, the worse it gets.
I think that point you made earlier that is 50 magic.
No.
Or if adopting a different granularity in your construction process,
yep,
would lead to materially different results. But you could actually run it with maybe 12, 15, 20,
yep,
to see how that would affect the number of matches in the construction,
yep,
process that you run. Hopefully be able to show that it's immaterial.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I've got it now as a runtime value I can put in at runtime, so I can do that. So this is, now I can go into a court of law and say, well, I'm an expert witness, here is code from one company, here is code from another company. Of course, you know, 5 lines of code in each is not going to be substantial, but if I can now say that, you know, 90% of the code is similar, then we've got a leg to stand on in terms of someone's copy from someone.
So if you gave an assignment in one of your classes for a specific set of functions.
Yep. I always tell them I use my program to compare each other.
What would you how much, if I've got 10 programs,
yep,
10 students, and they all did do them independently,
yep,
how much background similarity is there that this would show? If these are programs intended,
yep,
to do the same, have the same output.
Do you want to give you a percentage on each file?
No, just what would you expect to see as similarity?
You see, you know, for loops that are the same, and you see sort of basic if decisions that are the same, and you see a couple of assignment statements that turn out to be the same.
So what approximate percentage is that?
5%. Less than
10%. I think Berkeley did a study many years ago. They had a tool called Moss which did this similarity thing, and they said 30% was similar.
I see that.
Of uncopied programs.
So uncopied programs, you would end up with something in the range of 30%.
That's what they found for their sort of first and second year assignment.
I would say I'm seeing about 10%. It really depends upon what question you're asking.
Right.
If it's a very small program, the percentage is much higher.
Yeah. It probably depends a little bit if you're teaching the students off a textbook and you give some exemplars and they're expected to extend it.
Yep. Then you start to
get much higher. Building up.
And so that's where the question of what counts as similarity,
sure,
if you're going to take this into a legal setting,
yep,
or even an academic setting of you're making an accusation or a claim of copying.
There's also
now what we mean by similarity,
yep,
and what you might have missed or what is represented as,
yep,
falsely as similarity,
yep,
becomes an issue. And then suddenly if I come up with my program 40% similar, but the expectation is it's 30% similar.
Yep.
Well,
that's not substantially.
Now what's substantially?
Yeah.
Now what's the threshold at this point?
There's also
important.
But there's also qualitative versus quantitative. I mean, because we're also talking about creative output, someone who uses a very clever and cluey algorithm, which you would not expect another person to know, then you see that same algorithm appear in the other person's code. Then you start thinking, so it's not just percentages.
At this point, you've stepped out of the automation aspect.
Oh yeah, but this was never designed to automate completely the process. This was designed to be a filtration tool, so that you then go back and manually say, I don't want to spend 6 weeks doing the comparison. I want to spend 0.1 second doing the comparison, print the results out, and now I can focus.
Yeah,
on
and then look at only say 70% or higher.
Yeah. So it's never been a completely automated tool. It's always to assist the full comparison. Of course, human measurements and human ideas have got to come into the mix as well.
Yeah, because if the machine can do everything, you lose out on your expert witness.
That's right, yes. That's a loss of money. So. Okay, that's the end. So hopefully that was interesting and the last time you'll hear about it.